Hello and welcome to episode 25 of our podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg and I'm here as always with my co-host Perry Middlemiss. How are you coping there over there, Perry?
Pretty well, thanks, David. Yeah, it's not too bad. For us slightly introverted people, it's actually not such a bad time. We can always find plenty to do around the house, read books, watch TV, do jigsaws, just hang around out there on the internet. There's plenty to do, so I'm not finding things terribly onerous, but we're only about 3 weeks in, and for people listening to this sometime in the future, we're 3 weeks into a lockdown in Victoria for the COVID-19 coronavirus, and at the moment it looks like we've been told that we'll be locked in for at least another 6 weeks, or I think maybe seven, so at least until the end of May. So I'll be getting through a lot of books, I think, as long as I can stay away from all the other extraneous stuff.
Distractions, that's right.
Yeah, yes. The other distractions. But at least it also means that I'm trying to catch up on the on some of the recent science fiction television series, which is happening, and I'll be able to discuss that with a couple of other people in a few episodes ahead. But what about you, David? Everything ticking along well?
It's pretty much ticking on the as usual. I've been retired. My wife's been retired for a few years now, so there's not a lot changing the day to day, apart from the sort of semi-scary episodes of going out to buy groceries. But other than that, our day-to-day life hasn't altered a great deal. But yeah, I'm trying to get some reading done, and I started on that great thick slab of a book I mentioned last time, Hilary Mantel's The Mirror and the Light, which is extremely good so far. I'm only about 10% in, but it's very good. So I'm looking forward to finishing that.
I expect a report on that when you're finished.
Indeed. Well, the whole trilogy, I'd probably have to reread the first couple of books, but anyway, we'll see. And this pandemic has caused all sorts of ructions, as we know, around the world, and including affecting some large events like the Worldcon. This the Worldcon that was planned for New Zealand in August this year has had to do something different. What's that, Perry?
They've moved to a virtual event, which is pretty much all they can do. I know from some inside knowledge that they attempted to see whether they could push the event back a couple of months, but everything has to be booked a couple of years in advance, and there just wasn't any way they could possibly do it before the end of this year. And so they were really left with no choice, which is very sad, because these guys in New Zealand have worked on this for 10 years, working towards it gradually and then building up over the last few years. They've put a hell of a lot of effort into it, and it's just very sad that the convention can't be held there, because it's not so much just the basic machinery of a Worldcon that's useful, but as you'll know, David, a Worldcon basically brings all the tribes together.
Yeah.
They all come in from all around the world, and they come to a particular city, particular country, and that's a big fill-up for science fiction and science fiction fandom in that country. It happened three or four times here in Australia, and I was really hoping that New Zealand would get the same kick along that we got after 75 and 85 and 99 and 2010 here in Melbourne, but unfortunately isn't going to happen. But hopefully the virtual event will work out well, and it'll all go along smoothly.
It will. I think it's good, but one of the things that they are going to miss is what happens at a lot of conventions, a lot of conferences and so on, and that's that a lot of the really important stuff is what gets talked about in the corridors or at lunch or at the bar while the event's going on. So unfortunately that part of it will probably get missed. So anyway, yeah. Never mind. Nothing else can be done about it. So we'll see how they go. Look, I'm looking forward to looking at some of the panels and so on. I was never going to travel there anyway. So for me, I'll be able to see some of those things online now. So that'll be good.
It'll be interesting to see how it works. Hopefully, there will be some teething problems, but hopefully it'll tick along pretty well. And I just feel very sorry for them, and hope that it all works out as best as it possibly can.
Indeed. Now, the Hugo Awards, I believe, they will go ahead, and the nomination form, the form isn't out yet? Oh, the shortlist has been.
Yeah, the nominations have closed and the shortlist was released about a week or so ago. That's now out there and available, and hopefully we'll put a link to the shortlists in the show notes.
Indeed.
For this particular episode. I'll attempt again to try to read all of the main fiction categories. That's the novel, novella, novelette and short stories, and probably over a couple of episodes later on, in about a month or so, we'll start talking about those particular entries in the shortlist and let people know what I think of them and what where my votes are probably going to go. There's six entries on each of the lists. I've read three of the novels and three of the novellas, so that's a pretty good start. So I'm about halfway through those, but none of the novelettes or short stories. But luckily, they're shorter, and that's a good thing. I should be able to get through them. And if you're also a member of the convention, either attending or supporting, you will probably therefore be eligible to receive the Hugo packet, which is, as much as possible, one-off copies of each of the works that are on the shortlist, but all the novels, novelettes, short stories, novellas, etc. You don't necessarily get all of them. Sometimes it's just an excerpt, but it may give you a bit of a hint in terms of what the work is like and allow you to go looking for them online somewhere and purchase them. I'd suggest that if possible, you do so. I know it's can be a little bit difficult, David. One of our favourites, Infinite Detail from last year, didn't make the list, which is a bit of a pity. I had it on my nomination list, but it didn't get up. So, we had a feeling that it probably wouldn't, as I recall.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So it's just one of those things that happens, but there we go.
So one of the things that we thought we would do this episode is that we'd talk about how we got into science fiction. We've actually interviewed a couple of our friends about how they started off as a kid reading science fiction. What was it that sucked them into the genre and got them interested in this kind of fiction? And so we'll be featuring those interviews later in a little while. But Perry and I thought we'd have a bit of a chat first about what got us into the genre, what kind of books sucked us into reading science fiction and fantasy in the first place. Do you want to start doing that, Perry?
Yeah, well, it sort of goes back to, what do they say? The golden age of science fiction is, 12? Meaning that that's the year that you probably discover it and kick it off. I probably got there about that time, maybe a year or two earlier. I was living in a small country town in the mid-north of South Australia, and the only library in town was the school library. And it wasn't really that flash back in the 1960s. And so I read what I was given, and mostly that was English children's literature. Enid Blyton was the big one. You would remember that one, David.
Oh, yeah.
Secret Seven, Famous Five, that sort of stuff.
Magic Faraway Tree.
No, I didn't read that. No, that was
fair bit younger. You've got to be fair bit younger.
Yeah, a bit younger. No, this was a little bit older stuff, and I got into that and read that. I remember Biggles being mentioned to me, Captain W.E. Johns, with his massive series of books about Biggles in the Second World War being mentioned to me, but I really wasn't overly interested in that sort of stuff. So I didn't get into that. And then I moved from Enid Blyton and discovered Dr. Doolittle. Dr. Doolittle is, I think the return now is genre adjacent, but it really is YA fiction that is fantastic. And it's got talking animals and he travels all over the place and he actually goes to the moon on one occasion. And so this was partially in the genre, but I was lucky in that I've got a father who had been reading science fiction since the early 40s, and he had a lot of science fiction paperbacks around, and he also had a lot of copies of Astounding and Analog around, because that was his major fix each month. He had a subscription with the newsagent for that, so he'd get that every month. So I'd always see that lying around, occasionally pick it up, have a bit of a look at it to see whether it was of any interest and have a look through that. That probably led me on to things like, the standard run that a lot of blokes my age, so late 60s, early 70s at this stage, read, and that was the Clark, the Heinlein, the Asimov, the robot stories, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And that was stuff that my father had lying around that he had read, he had kept, and I read that. And I think I was thinking about this the other day, and I was trying to work out what was the first author that I found that my father hadn't read. And I reckon it was probably Larry Niven, because he was writing that series of known space stories back in the late 60s into the 70s, where he was dealing with the Zinti and the Pearson's Puppeteer. And this was all good gung-ho stuff, you know, all good space opera aliens. And I'm thinking about it now. I looked at it the other day and I thought, surely he must have published a lot of these in Astounding or Analog. I mean, the stories that he wrote was completely right up John Campbell's alley. You know, basically, there was always some human who knew better than the aliens, even though they had higher or more advanced technology. But rat cunning and wit normally got the human through far better than the aliens possibly could have. But I found out that he wrote practically nothing for Analog. In fact, for the first couple of years, I can't find anything that he wrote for them. Most of the stuff he was publishing was in Galaxy and If, and that wasn't stuff. And also F&SF, oddly enough. But my father didn't read F&SF because it had fantasy at the front, and he's not a fantasy fan at all. And I don't think that he ever got into Galaxy or If magazine. He might have picked up one or two copies here and there, but he never actually bought it on a regular basis. So I think Niven was the first one that I started to read. And then once you get to there and you start moving away and you start picking up books of your own, and this one looks interesting and that one looks interesting, and then you move to, at that stage in the 60s, it was the New Wave, so there was Dish and Dick and Le Guin, and then it just carried on from there. And it's been a major part of my reading life for the last 50, 55 years.
Indeed.
And I really enjoy it. Not always. There's some stuff that you think, this isn't really terribly good, isn't terribly well written. Mm. And then every now and again you come across something and you think, now I remember why I read this stuff. This is fantastic.
Yes.
And it gives you that classic sense of wonder that you always had, you know, lying out on the lawn at, after midnight and staring at the stars and looking up there and wondering what the hell was up there. And this was the science fiction that allowed you to imagine what might have been there.
Mm, that
so
sense of
I've
wonder,
always enjoyed yeah. it. Yeah, yeah, that all sense yeah. of wonder. It's yeah. all good stuff.
Yeah, good
stuff. What about you, David? Where did your stuff come from?
Well, as you mentioned, the Enid Blyton, and I still remember the books were written for quite young kids, I suppose, things like The Magic Faraway Tree and all those sort of fantasy books that she wrote for kids. But they were quite fun at the time. So that sort of got me into that sort of genre of a little bit of magic, a little bit of fantasy. And I remember we had a terrific library in the town where I lived in England, town of Saltaire. And it was a terrific library, and they had heaps of books in the kids' library. And I remember reading an awful lot of myths and legends. There was a whole series of books which were dedicated to the myths and legends of different nations, different countries. And so I picked up, I think, every one of those, including some Japanese myths and stories.
Oh, okay.
Really interesting sort of stuff. But the author that really pulled me in was Edith Nesbit, who wrote as E. Nesbit. And she was writing around the turn of the 19th into 20th century, sort of early Edwardian era. And her books have a lot of magic in them. But there was one particular book, which was it's called The Story of the Amulet, which features time travel, which is a pretty unusual theme for a kid's book. And it's interesting, in fact, that she knew H.G. Wells quite well. They were both part of the Fabian Society together. And but the story of the amulet is very interesting in that they get this magical device, this amulet, this Egyptian amulet, or Babylonian amulet, can't remember now, which through which they can travel back to the past. I won't explain why they're doing that. But also at one point, they use the device to travel into the future. And that's a really interesting passage of sort of half a chapter of where they're going to the future. So the idea is they're going to the future to find something which they think they will have found as adults. And so they go to 50 years of 60 years into the future, something like that, when they'll be grown up and old. And so it's, I guess, from the early 1900s, she's sort of imagining what the world would have been like in 1960, 1970. And it's really quite interesting because a lot of it's actually quite accurate in the sense that that kids marvel at the fact that the River Thames is clean and doesn't smell anymore. And they walk through a park and they see fathers playing with their children in the park. This is seen as something astounding. And then they meet this little boy who's sobbing because he's been expelled from school for the day. He's really upset because he can't stay at school. And this kid's name is Wells. He was named after the great reformer. But there's all this really lovely stuff in there. And that sort of really got me into the whole concept of time travel. And so that was really an introduction to that sort of idea. And then, of course, like we've discussed before on this podcast, I read a lot of comics, Superman comics, Flash, The Green Lantern, all those sort of books, which kind of introduce you to other worlds and alien threats and weird things. I also remember from the kids' library there reading the Cities in Flight series by James Blish. Did you ever read that?
No.
That's where...
I know of it. I may have read one of the first novel, but not as a kid.
They'd invent some sort of device, which I think they call spin dizzies. Mm. And these devices let them take whole cities, lift them off the surface of the earth and travel through space in a bubble. And so you follow the story of the city of New York, which is taken off into space. And it's still run by a mayor rather than a governor or a president. It's just the one city. And there's a whole lot of these other cities, American cities, of course, because he was an American writer. But that was a lot of fun. And you mentioned Captain W.E. Johns before and all those Biggles books. I never got into Biggles, but he actually wrote 10 science fiction stories for kids, starting with Kings of Space, which was written in 1954. Out of Wikipedia, because I can't remember the book, but Wikipedia says, follows the interplanetary adventures of retired RAF group captain Timothy Tiger Clinton, his son Rex, scientist Professor Lucius Brain, who invents a spaceship powered by cosmic rays, and Brain's resourceful butler, Judkins. I feel like going back and reading it again. Sounds like a lot of fun.
I never heard of that one. Growing up.
Yeah, he wrote 10 science fiction books all in the same series. I didn't read them all. I read the first couple, I think. But that got me into this kind of real classic space opera type of science fiction. And then my father, like you've mentioned your father, my father had a whole lot of collection of Edgar Rice Burroughs. So we had the Tarzan books, which I read all those Tarzan books, and Princess of Mars, all those things. Pellucidar, which is about the Hollow Earth, I think, if I remember rightly, all that sort of stuff. So that I sort of really got into it through those sort of mechanisms. And then, you know, the Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, all those things, of course, I started getting into pretty well, pretty early. And then they allowed me into the adult library, which I think was at about the age of about 12, must have been about 12. And there I found all those Arthur C. Clarke's books that you mentioned. I particularly remember The City in the Stars. Yep. Which is about this city of the future, which is kind of closed in on itself, and people who want to go outside the city are seen as psychologically aberrant, and there's something wrong with them because everything's inside the city. And then all the Asimov books, like you mentioned too, the robot books, the Foundation series, all that sort of stuff. Great stuff. So yeah, that's how I got into reading all this stuff, and like as with you, I haven't ever really let go of it since then. But in recent years, I've been reading less and less science fiction. I think I'm reading more outside the genre than inside the genre.
Well, I've gone through periods in my life where, over a 10-year period, for example, I probably read probably two science fiction books a year, and all the rest of it was crime, literary stuff, a whole lot of different things. So you just go through various phases in your life, and that's fine. But I've just come back to it now, looking at all those paperbacks sitting up on the shelf, thinking I've got a chance to read them once. Yeah. And that's it. I'm not going to get back to them again. And then every now and again, you, like I did about three or four years ago, pull a book off the shelf, and I thought, oh, Dying Inside by Robert Silverberg. I don't reckon I've ever read this. Mm. And I opened it up, and there's my signature in the front. Stupidly, I used to put my name in everything all the time. And I reckon I've had that book on the shelf for over 35 years before I actually read it. Which is a bit silly because it's a damn good book.
That's the case. I've got a lot of books on my shelf I've never actually opened, but I've been trying, because I have limited space to store books. I've been pretty carefully going through and getting rid of books I think I'm never going to read. So I have lost a number of those. Yeah, so that's sorry, go on.
No, that's it. I was just thinking that the same thing. I think that I'm at the time where I'm going to have to move them from out of this house at some point. So my best bet is to work my way through the old stuff. And when I've finished it, well, the book just gets donated to a charity of some sort, and somebody else can have a go at it and see what happens.
Indeed. Now, the other thing we ought to mention is that our next episode, which will be number 26, and since we publish episodes roughly fortnightly, you can do the math and find out that our next episode, number 26, will be our first anniversary episode. We'll have been doing this thing for a year, which seems...
Who would have thought it?
We never thought we'd get to pass a couple of episodes. So, yeah, that'd be interesting. So we've got a special episode lined up, and we'll be talking about some of our very favourite books of all time. And so we've been thinking about what those will be, and so we'll talk about that then. So we're now going to talk to a couple of different people about their introduction to science fiction. And the first of these is...
W.H. Chong. Chong was on the program a couple of weeks back, talking about his favourite books that he read of last year. But just as an introduction again, he's a well-known artist, book designer, works for Text Publishing, a blogger, a writer, a culture vulture, as he likes to refer to himself, and a science fiction reader. And he's very heavily into Ian Banks. And so he and I have had some long discussions about Banks's material. And this is an interesting chat with somebody who doesn't have exactly the same background as David or I. Now, David grew up in England. I grew up in Australia. But Chong is from Malaysia, and so he has... Well, he'll tell you. This basically... He'll give you all the background. I don't want to basically steal his thunder. Better off if he introduces it and lets us know where he came from. How was it you became a science fiction reader? Where did you start?
I guess because one reads, and it's what do you read? So at 13, I tried reading Lord of the Rings, which didn't take at all. I tried reading it for three consecutive December holidays, and it did take three goes to actually get started.
To get started,
yes.
You know, fair
and
enough.
And then only did I read The Hobbit, which is stupid.
Should have gone there first.
Correct, but nobody told me.
That's the problem. So did you have anybody in your background that read either science fiction or fantasy?
Not at all.
Ah.
I was the youngest kid in the house, and there's nobody around really, so I just did whatever. Not at all interested in my brother's books, so I just found the stuff. I don't know. And that was about the same time I started reading science fiction, inverted commas. Asimov, I think. Mm-hmm. The Robots. Mm-hmm. Caves of Steel, which I really enjoyed because I can imagine growing up in a place like that. Foundation, of course. And Asimov is a fantastic entry point because a very good explainer, very plain, banal kind of style. So anyway, he was like one of the starting points. And the other person was Arthur Clarke. and I really connected to Clark. There was an early book, a YA story called Dolphin Island. It's very obscure, I think. He wrote it in 63. A story of a boy living in a deadbeat Midwest USA and somehow finds himself whisked away because he's trying to run away in a hydrocraft, and one thing leads to another, ends up on a tropical paradise off the coast of Queensland, and there are dolphins involved as well. So it's kind of like a dream thing for a young kid to read, and I was imagining all that stuff for me too. And then, you know, he had just this fantastic run in the 70s, so he wrote this amazing story called A Meeting with Medusa, which I think led on to the chiming, the rendezvous with Rama, and then Imperial Earth, and then Fountains of Paradise, stunning things. And I just thought he really was awe-inspiring for me, you know, all that sense of wonder stuff. He sort of gave me a sense of an idea of freedom, which I couldn't really make sense of. And in retrospect, what was about was the freedom to do what you wanted to with the book, what was about. So it didn't have to be, you know, Charles Dickens. It could just be about ideas. It could be about delimited.
So did you see that as being an escape from your childhood, or was it offering you something that you couldn't get in your childhood at all?
I was like any kid on a small planet far away from the galactic center, wanting to be close to the middle where you could see the sky bright with stars. That's all. Right. Same.
Yep.
Luke Skywalker, whatever.
Yep. Okay. Now, that's a fairly common thing. People will be, I don't know, very much from my perspective, growing up in a small country town out in the middle of nowhere, the stars were bright at night, but there wasn't much happening during the day. And finding science fiction as being a means to escape from that sort of drab sort of existence that you had as a teenager was my reason for getting into it. Did you see something similar happening there?
Well, growing up in a sort of colonial outpost, which was what KL was in those times, was certainly a desire on my part to get somewhere faster and brighter. But apart from that, what science fiction did do for me was the idea that there were ideas, that there were not just a physical space, but a whole different idea space one could go into. You know, that things could mean different things, it could be about different things. They didn't have to be the boring, banal things of everyday. Amazing, amazing spaces.
Mm. So you started off with the classics. Were you reading Hong Kong?
They were easy to get.
Yes, well, they were everywhere because you, Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, you were probably getting a lot of the Commonwealth books from the UK. So you were getting probably similar types of editions that we were getting in Australia. Would that be right, or were they being printed there separately?
I would expect that we had a much smaller selection than you would have had here.
Right.
Of every kind of book.
Yep.
So the authors you were most likely to get, of course, were the big ones.
Yep.
I'm sure there were Heinlein. I've never read Heinlein. I've never read any of the Dune books either.
Okay.
I have huge holes in my reading. I mean, I did read the classics, but only a few of the classics.
I think all of us have got big holes in our reading from one point or another, because there's so much out there that you can't, trying to cover the whole field right across from both ends, all the way right through from ultra-hard science right down to high fantasy, is pretty difficult to do.
I'm sure that's right, but it was, even though it was hard then, it's a whole lot easier. It was a whole lot easier back then than now.
Yes.
Now it's just impossible.
Well, you go back and have a look at, say, in a recent episode of this podcast, we were looking at the novels, science fiction novels from 1960. There were five on the Hugo ballot, and you could probably pick up by me about another 10, 12 that you would think would be among the best of the year that were published in English in that year. Let's say 20 all up. Now, Locus recommended reading list, on the novel list, there's about 35 or 40 SF books about the same number of fantasy novels, and that's just the recommended stuff. It's not all the others that were just out there, the huge mass of publishing that goes on these days. It's difficult.
I had a look at that list too, just to prompt myself whether or not there were any books I had read, and I was staggered. I just thought, oh my God. And I had read like maybe one on the entire complete list of 120 or whatever. I just felt sad.
Really. No, you can't really feel sad about it. You have to look at it from the perspective that, well, I look at it from the perspective that this is my recommended list from that this particular year, 2019. And so I will be looking at that for the awards that are going to be coming up. But it's the works that are going to be there that are nominated for the awards that are going to be my prompting, because they're the ones I'm going to read. Because for whatever reason, somebody has decided, somebody, a bunch of voters, juries, have decided that that is going to be the ones that you're going to read. Back when you were starting, to read, you didn't have that. Were you aware of the Hugo Awards back then? Did you see the stickers on the books?
You've thrown me two balls I do want to catch, but I can only do one of them at a time. So just with this, your Hugo reading list, and how it's a member-voted award, I find it such a tricky thing, because you know how all literary awards function like a lottery.
Yes.
You know, whether you win or not, that's not very much to do with the notion that you're the very best that year. It's just what happened on the day with a bunch of different judges. And with the Hugo system, where it's all peer nominated or reader nominated or whatever, and being voted in that way, it strikes me as even a more tricky kind of business, because there's no, well, I guess there's some level curating because of the nominations. But for instance, one of the best books I had read for years up to that point was Adam Roberts' The Thing Itself. Mm-hmm. And it hardly appeared on any list. Mm. It was an astonishing, absolutely brilliant, mind-bendingly fantastic book. And it barely got a notice. And then I saw later that Adam Roberts himself had written a blog expressing his disappointment, you know, in very sad kind of self-conscious, slightly self-pitying tones. And I really felt sorry for him, because it was such a great book and it didn't get picked up.
That happens.
Yeah.
It's odd. So were you aware of the award system when you were growing up?
No.
And reading them?
No. No, I was just reading because I would have read almost anything you put in front of me.
Were you finding the books in the bookstores or in the library? Or
we did have them at school in the library, so I just chased down every one of them and read all of them. But still, you know, even back then there was a kind of natural selectivity. There's a reason why I didn't read Heinlein or Dune, and it's a taste and tone thing. Mm. I think you know without knowing why, you know, some things you like, some things you don't.
Yes. Also, sometimes it's the librarian's choice as to whether those books are there or not. But sure. Assume that.
But there were no naughty books back then.
No. Well, June's not a naughty book, but it is a big book. And being published as it was in the mid-60s, if you were reading it later than that, and you first coming in, those earlier books, the Asimov's, Clarke's, they're all 200, 250 at the outside. So they're a good classic size for a novel. And then you get to Dune, which is, I don't know, 500 pages or something. It actually looks a bit daunting from time to time.
500 pages is daunting for me now.
Well, it's certainly daunting when you were about sort of 14 or 15. So you were reading in your teens, and you were reading all the classic SF that was going through. So how did that progress through? Where did you move to from there? Did you start coming across other writers?
So I made a list of a bunch of authors who did mean something to me. So it'd be Ursula Le Guin, one. Mm-hmm. Philip K. Dick's another. Samuel R. Delaney is another. Ian M. Banks is a really big one. So these are all the early kind of books. Mm. Banks is a bit later. I think the early stuff kind of rounded up around Samuel Delaney, who was, of course, the most interesting, being the kinkiest of the lot.
Yes.
And all these people meant different things to me. So Arthur Clarke, his three books had real hooks for me. Rendezvous with Rama, I don't know if you recall it very well.
Yes, I read it.
Has, you know, one of the most ingenious last lines of any novel.
Oh, okay, that's not fair. I don't remember the last line.
So what happens is the protagonist wakes up and he thinks to himself, the Ramans do everything in threes.
Ah.
And I was just puzzled for a whole week, and when the penny dropped, I just burst out laughing. It was such a brilliant line. So that made me very excited for the implied sequels.
Yes.
And Imperial Earth, I stayed up one night reading a large chunk of it, and sometime during that night, inspired by the book, I swear that I saw and understood the concept of zero and infinity. And not for very long, and never again, but was totally lucid. I could see it. And I'm sure that had everything to do with reading that book. And Fountains of Paradise, which has not had the best reviews, was set in Sri Lanka, where Clark lived at the end. And what that did for me was it opened up the whole of Equatorial East Asia as a site where the future could also happen. You know, it made palm trees and Buddhist signifiers as normal a part of the future as skyscrapers. So books do things to you that you wouldn't think it might, because they mean different things to different folk.
Do you think that was the first science fiction novel you read with an Asian setting?
Absolutely.
Okay. You know, I'd be hard pressed to think of one that came out earlier than that. There may well have been, but off the top of my head, I can't think of any. So there was Clark, and then so you moved through, well, what we would basically, I suppose, call the New Wave, that Delaney, Dick, Le Guin sort of run, and then moved on to Ian Banks later on. So Banks really
kicked off.
Well,
hang on. Oh, we can't leap Le Guin and...
No, we can't. Like no, not really.
Because they did something similar for me in their way, but in a very different way. So Le Guin was about literary quality and intense human feeling, not stuff you got from either Asimov or Clarke or many of these kind of blokes, for instance. You know, The Left Hand of Darkness, that bit about crossing the glacier and the incredible, shocking coda to that was amazing. I thought, you can do this with writing. Yes, so in The Left Hand of Darkness, there's this crucial passage where they cross the glacier. And then right after they cross the glacier, there's a really shocking coda. And I was just knocked out. I thought, wow, you can do this with writing. So I was, you know, closet reading literary stuff because of Le Guin. This is in a genre book, supposedly.
Yes.
So that made a huge difference for me, because I hadn't thought it was possible. With Samuel Delaney, he wrote something like Dahlgren. I don't know that I ever finished reading the 1,000 pages of Dahlgren, but I got it, you know, that kind of dizzy, hazy, post-hippie kind of liberation. And he was himself the very concept of diversity in the flesh.
Mm.
He expanded, for me certainly, the horizon lines of the erotic and the imagination. But the other person we've left out here is Philip K. Dick, who I just loved for the titles. You know, he wrote the greatest titles ever. The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, Beyond Lies the Wub, The Father Thing, The Man in the High Castle, The Days of Perky Pat, Crazy Story, We Can Remember It for You Wholesale. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep really blew my mind, and I can't even remember what happened.
Well, you've seen the film. You've seen Blade Runner.
It's got nothing to do with the book whatsoever.
It's got a bit. It's got the basic outline, but it's not the book. It's certainly not the book.
Yeah, I reread the book after the film. I thought, wow, this has nothing to do with the book. Well, I guess there is a sense in which they have the same theme. The book seemed to me to be about religion. The film was a notion of humanity / spirituality.
I saw it as a discussion on identity. What is it to be human? So you could say that's spirituality, but you know.
Sure. But think of the ending. He gives up the ghost.
Yes.
You know, the bird flies off.
Yeah. So he, Descartes is actually trying to determine really whether he's human or not, and he's not really terribly sure.
I think, in retrospect, it's even more peculiar than that. He's not just trying to think, well, he's human. I think you could read further and think that here's a being who is just trying to understand what being is. So being human or not is almost besides the point here. It's like you're here, whatever you are. What is it? Why?
Yeah, okay. So Dick was important to you? How old were you when you were reading these writers? Delaney, Le Guin, Dick?
Oh, I would say late teens all the way through to 30.
Oh.
I wouldn't claim to have understood a lot of it. I did reread a few of these books. Certainly, I reread the Le Guin's, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could get Dick without understanding a lot of it. In fact, I'm not quite sure that you can understand very much of it. But you get his thing.
You do.
You get the whole crazy and wide business in his head. And that's the key thing, I think.
If you read three or four or five or six of them in a short space of time, you seem to enter this particular Dickian universe that is quite perplexing. Well, it's really quite strange, and it actually starts making a bit of sense, and you start seeing regular themes popping up and regular things happening, and you think, I think this is doing strange things to my head. Now, I don't know whether that's sort of knowledge after the fact, knowing that he was a bit of a drug taker, and therefore you think that that was what was happening, or whether it is actually the books themselves that are doing it to
Isn't
you.
That the power of art? The strong artist is the one who makes you see the world in their way,
in a different
you
way.
You go into, you know, a show of Jeffrey Smart or maybe Picasso. You come out and you see things. You see shapes in the landscape. You see angles in people's faces.
Yes.
And Dick was had an amazingly distinctive universe.
I find it easier to see Jeffrey Smart in the landscape than Picasso, to be perfectly frank.
I can see Picasso in your face now, Perry.
Yeah, well, I feel like that sometimes, like I'm sliding off. But Jeffrey Smart, that small man sitting all the way over there in this big sort of industrial landscape, it's very much a sort of a Phil Dick sort of view in some ways, because he's got ordinary people, mainly men, ordinary men who are just lost, who don't know what's going on. The world is impacting them on a huge scale, and they have no idea why, and they don't have any idea about how to impact it and get off. So it's a very interesting and very very
really
good.
That sounds like we're all living in a Dickian universe.
Oh, I think we are. I think we're getting closer to one all the time. So I think that's fair enough. I think he was very prescient.
Well, one thing that I always thought about him, and I must go back to see whether this is true, is I thought he was a really bad, clunky writer. His ideas were so fantastic, but sentence by sentence, I just felt like I was stumbling over at the end of every sentence on the period.
Yeah, I can understand that. I can think that you couldn't get to the point where, yes, he is not the greatest stylist in the universe, but there's just something about him that I find peculiar. So that was some of the major influences on you early.
That would have done for a lifetime.
I would have thought so. Yeah, there's a fair bit there. Do you find that you can go back and reread those authors that you've mentioned? Maybe not so much Clarke and Asimov so much anymore, but can you go back and, you said you've reread Le Guin. Have you gone back and read any of Delaney's at all?
Well, let me answer that in a sideways manner. So I think titles and covers are important to me, more important than for a lot of people, I suppose.
Yeah.
I'm always harking back to Orhan Pamuk, who had a great quote, which I like. If years after reading a book, we catch sight of its cover, we return at once to that long ago day when we curled up in a corner with that book to enter the world within.
Yep.
And titles bring up the same kind of feeling as a cover might. So if I, you know, come across the titles, "We in Some Strange Powers Employ Move on a Rigorous Line," and also "Time Considered as a Helix of Semi-Precious Stones," I get the whole Delaney feeling. I can't tell you what happened in the story, but I get the feeling.
Okay, so there's just this sort of emotional and experiential trigger that you get based on the title or the cover of the book.
Yeah. I'm very bad at remembering plots and characters, but I remember the feeling.
Mm.
Mm. And I think, really, I've only been able to go back to read Le Guin and maybe bits of Delaney just because they were starless. I find it very hard to read bad prose anymore. As you say, there just isn't enough time.
That is true. And I think that's fair enough. I don't think you should... I think as a writer, you've got to be, or a reader, you've got to be able to say, no, this isn't for me, and just move on.
See, genre writers have all been trained now in a way that nobody was trained to write in the old days. They know how to write, you know, whether or not you connect with their style is another thing, but they all know how to write. They've been taught how to construct, how to scrub the sentences, how to pull it all together. The editing is probably much better now. I don't know, but it certainly feels to me like everybody writes better on a sentence-by-sentence level.
I think that's probably true. Do you still feel that you're getting the same things out of science fiction that you're reading now as you did back when you were in your 20s or 30s?
That's a very good question, and I'll ask it of you shortly. I don't think so. So I've just read William Gibson's Agency. I read every Gibson book that comes out. I find him very compelling in particular ways. But since, let's say, since this century, I guess, when did it start for him? Something like Pattern Recognition, I think. What I enjoy most about his books are not the science fictional bits in it. It's just the way he sees the world, the little bits he picks up, the textures of the sentences. I could pick up Agency now and just turn to any page and quote you a line which I find particularly Gibsonian, which I find just exciting on a writing level, and I just really enjoy that more than anything else.
Okay. I find that I get different things out of it. I've been talking on the podcast about going back and rereading some books that I can remember having read back in my teens and 20s. And absolutely hating them. Old Man and the Sea is a classic. Just did not like it at all. Didn't get it. Couldn't work out what the whole this bloody thing was about. This old guy sort of doing all this stuff. It just didn't made no sense to me at all. And yet now I go back and read it, as I did about a year or so ago, and it all made perfect sense to me. It all just flowed. So the change.
Do you feel closer to the old man or the sea?
Well, no, certainly not closer to the sea. I'm not really a sea person at all. I don't mind paddling in it, but that's about as far as I go. No, more about the age and being able to identify more with the character. Back when I was younger, with very little experience or no experience, I had no hope of being able to work out what was going on.
He was quite young when you wrote that.
Yes, I know, but he certainly knew a lot of old guys because he got it right. And yet, they used to give the Old Man in the Sea to people like me as a 15-year-old.
Because it was a short book.
Well, it's a short book, and so here you are, what do you think about this? So you go and have a look at it, you read it, and you think, this is a load of copulous. It's just awful. You hated it.
I think it's the same feeling that older people get who haven't read it when they were young, when if they're given Catching the Rye. If you read Catching the Rye when you're 40, you just think, this is a whole load of bunk. It's just hypocritical nonsense written by somebody who calls everybody else a hypocrite.
I read Catcher in the Rye in my teens, hated it. I read it again in my 40s, and I still hated it. And I will never go back and read it again. I think it's one of the most overrated... I think it's one of the most overrated books of the 20th century that people consider to be a classic. But that's just purely my point of view. I hate the lead character, Holden Caulfield. I hate him so much, I remember his name.
As we all know, Holden has closed down.
Well, very apropos, that's good. But basically, there's some books that come back to me. There's some books, as I've said just recently on the podcast, that if I'd read when I was 15, I would have absolutely loved. And I still like them. I'm still reading them for the first time in my 60s, and I can still say, yeah, well, this is a good book.
Example?
Well, the one, The High Crusade by Paul Anderson that I just read.
I was just wondering whether if maybe SF books age more badly other kinds of books.
Oh, some of them are shocking. Some of them are really, really terrible. And you read them and you think, oh my God, this guy had absolutely no idea. Because he was trying to depict a future society and how people would react into it and then talk in it. And now you get to read it and you think, nah, doesn't work. Venus Plus X by Theodore Sturgeon's another one. Back in the 1960s, in 1960 when this was written, this would have been this was a fairly major book, and it would have been rather shocking to people. Depicting an androgynous society, people would have found it rather difficult. You read it now and you think, well, this is old hat. I mean, we're past all this, aren't we? But it's just because it reads as if it is a product very much of its time and not so much a product of our time. Whereas others which don't purport to run a very strong line in terms of a polemic...
So when they're not trying to predict.
When they're not trying to predict, or when they're not trying to be... to push a cause. To push something which we've moved past.
Well, then Dispossessed pushes a cause.
Yeah, but we're getting to one of my all-time favourite books here, so we better be careful about
it. I love it.
I love it. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I will brook absolutely no criticism of this book whatsoever.
I actually think it's less well-written than The Left Hand of Darkness.
Oh, okay. All right. I think I've got friends who might argue the toss over with you over that one, but I can understand why. The Left Hand of Darkness and The Dispossessed, if they were the only two books she had written in her whole career, she would still have been considered to be one of the best science fiction writers that ever walked the face of the earth, in my view.
Agree.
So I'm just putting that out there. I will certainly reread those two again. When I get to them, I'm not sure, but I still will get to them. I was actually talking to my daughter about this the other day. She was talking about, she said, oh, I read Left Hand of Darkness, oh, I didn't like it much. And I said, oh, okay.
How old is she?
She's 26. And I said, 27. And I said to her, well, have you read The Dispossessed? No. And I said, Shevik's one of the all-time great characters in science fiction. She said, how do you remember his name? How long ago did you read this? I said, I don't know, 15 years ago? I mean, how do you remember his name? Well, because he's just stuck. There he is. He's part of me, you know. So the same thing as Jen Lee I. He's from the main character of the Left Hand of Darkness. They're part of me because I read them at particular times of my life that it made a big impact. Did you remember?
They were your Holden Caulfield.
They're the Holden Caulfield. Do you have any of those particular characters from science fiction early days that have stuck with you that you remember? You said you don't remember plots very much. Do you remember the characters?
I can't say there are many characters I would have identified with. And it would be very early. It would probably be somewhere in the Clark oeuvre.
I'm not saying so much identify with, but just remembering the character. I don't identify with Shevik because he does some terrible things in that particular book. But I just remember him as a character.
Yeah, I do remember characters. And I think that's up to the author more than me, really. You know, if they do a bang-up job, I'm pretty sure I will remember it.
Okay, good.
Even if I can't remember their name, because I'm very bad with names.
That's very okay. Bad. But you do remember...
I do remember Shevik.
Yes, there you go. Good.
What was the name of the love interest? There are probably two, I think.
Well, you're dispossessed.
Yes.
No, they're gone.
What was the name of the character in Left Hand of Darkness?
Estraven? Estraven?
Yes, that's the local guy who was the...
The main character.
Who was the...
The mobile.
The mobile.
Generally,
Very good. You're very good.
I remember those. No, they stick. They stick. Some things just stick. I don't know why, but if you were to ask me...
Can you describe in your mind what Estraven looked like from memory?
No, not really. But that was the interesting thing about it, where this came out with Le Guin and the film versions of the Earthsea stories, where the first versions of it were, they were all white bread Americans. And she was horrified and said, no, that wasn't what she was after. Her view was that all of her people were sort of coffee-coloured, café au lait. They were a sort of a standard sort of colour all the way across. So that wasn't, because she didn't want race to be part of the issue. She simplified it and put it down into a particular on talents and gifts as opposed to race and hierarchical structures. And she does say in The Left Hand of Darkness there is one sentence, I think only one sentence, where the colour of his skin is actually mentioned. And I sort of remembered that, and I had a picture of all of them in that particular book as being the same sort of colour. I don't read characters as being white unless or
the mobile, I think, is described as dark.
Yes. Whereas the others were probably a lighter.
You know that stupid experiment that Penguin did recently where they repackaged classic books with diverse characters?
All right.
And which had such a huge backlash. So for instance, for Frankenstein, they put a picture of Frankenstein's monster as a black guy with knobs on his neck in an illustration. And they did that a whole lot of other things like Wizard of Oz. And they had a Captain Ahab as a black guy too, a dark-colored guy. And it had a tremendously negative backlash and they pulled it almost before it got to the shop. But you could have done that usefully with Le Guin.
Absolutely.
Because usually the transmission is your standard white bread.
Yep, that's right.
I reread Earthsea after she died, and it seemed to me clearer then that it wasn't so obviously stated. You really brought yourself to the thing, or you could bring yourself to the thing, and it could be whatever kind of shape and colour you liked.
Yes.
And I just had forgotten how emotionally tough they were, those books. They were kind of like a whole template for extremely rugged YA emotions.
They get tougher and tougher the further you go on.
Well, because she got older.
Well, yes, and also...
The last book.
She started to get more and more into death at the end, and that's quite emotional, some of those books. So you read those when you were in a Le Guin phase, early days?
You mean the first time round?
Mm.
Yes, I would have tended to read whole blocks of authors.
Yeah. Well, the problem here in Australia was the Earthsea books were put out in a puffin edition that looked like kiddies' books. And I think I picked them up purely on the basis that I thought so much of The Left Hand of Darkness. And I was thinking, these are going to be kiddies' books. And I was blown away by them, by how good they were. And it was unfortunate that they were put into those puffin editions.
I think it was a good thing, actually. I think it was suitable and a good thing because what a great way to get kids into this kind of thing.
From that perspective, I suppose that was all right.
Fantastic.
It wasn't good for me because I was coming at them from a later time. But then I didn't read a lot of that fantastic YA stuff that was around, you know, like the Alan Garner stuff and the Brising Amen stuff and all that.
Yeah, Garner was great.
Garner was great. And I didn't read Susan Cooper and play people like that until
I did not know Susan Cooper.
The Darkest Rising sequence. I didn't read any of that until I got into my 20s and 30s. And by that stage, I got to the point where I decided I don't care whether it's YA or science fiction or adult or anything. If somebody recommends it, I like it, I'm going to do it.
Get onto a tram holding a Harry Potter book cover.
I don't care. I don't care. Most of the time I'm on the tram, if I'm on a tram or a train and I'm reading a book, it's on a e-reader so nobody can read it. But I do actually like sitting on the train and surreptitiously looking around and seeing what people are reading, what sort of books
they're all reading on their phones.
No, there's quite a lot of people I see on trains that are reading actual printed books.
And do they read SF?
Sometimes they do. Sometimes it's quite peculiar that you'll see somebody reading and go, oh my God, they're reading something from about, you know, they're reading an Ian Banks novel or early Ian Banks, or they're reading something that they've obviously pulled off their shelf or their father's shelf from the 1960s. So I think, I recognise that edition. I've got that one at home. Strange things that you see people you reading. And that's good. I think it's great. I think it's tremendous. So you said to me a little while back that you're not reading as much now as you used to. You're finding don't have the time or just not getting there?
Yes. The last 10 or 20 years have been a much more selective kind of process. And it's because I have less time and my tastes have changed. And style and tone are far, far more important to me than they ever were. And I just will not read a book I don't like. I will give it 30 or 40 pages and that's it.
Well, I'm willing to give it 50 to 60. But yeah. I can understand 30 to 40. There's a heck of a lot of books that I've finished which I thought were okay, but the first 30 or 40 pages were just...
Well,
plain
I have
awful.
To read professionally. Yeah. And I have to read books I don't want to read.
Oh, okay, yes.
So if I'm reading for pleasure, it's got to be pleasure.
No, that's fair enough. So do you differentiate your reading that you're doing professionally for the publisher that you work for as opposed to the stuff that you pull off the shelf and you make a choice of reading yourself?
Isn't that the difference?
Yeah, well, that's what the point. I guess that is. The idea that
Philip Larkin put out a collection of criticism which had the great title Required Writing. So for work I do required reading.
Right.
And everything else is pleasure.
Yes. So it has to be that way. Yep. So who are you reading in the field now that you think is doing good work? Gibson, for one, is still there.
I am not a useful person to ask that question at all.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm so spotty. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that, because I'm old school like that, that this is all read in the last century, which really did stuff for me. So the Ian M. Banks culture novels, which I thought were everything that Star Trek The Next Generation was not, was actually sophisticated. As optimistic but skeptical, and it was the sheer rush and joy of his invention. He was loose and he was sexy, and it was crushing that he died when he was 59.
So much of the stuff I'm reading now, I can put as a big arc back to when he started and what he did with all that culture.
And Leckie.
And Leckie's an ass.
Who denies it?
Well, she says she didn't read it. So, I don't know. It just seems...
Transmission.
Well, it's transmission of some sort, because certainly there's a situation where I thought it was pretty obvious that that was what had happened. But as you say, she said that she hadn't read it. But it was a direct
list. I was just quoting.
But there's a whole lot of things that I read now. You know, Gareth Powell and... a whole lot of other writers that are writing and using Elliot de Bodard, who uses really large AIs in ships that have a mind of their own.
Do they write as well as he did? You know how his...
Differently.
He just wrote with such an effortless kind of... what's the word for it? He was like an acrobat. He was like a trapeze artist. Yeah. Everything seemed So simple for him to do.
So easy, yeah. It's quite strange. I don't think at his best, there were times when Banks basically just ran away from with himself, and you know there were books he read. You know,
in the culture novels or with the
I haven't read them all. I will admit I haven't read them all. I'm still only about halfway through, but I've heard.
You mean
that,
all his books or the culture books?
Well, some of the culture books. There's a couple of them there that are the big ones near the end where he just seemed to, from what I've heard, got a little bit on a roll and just kept on going, and these people sort of thought this isn't really quite up to his normal standard.
I've enjoyed all his culture books.
Okay, well that's good.
And even if he runs away with himself, there's only one Ian Banks.
That's true.
Let him run.
Well, I think you're right there. I think there is only one Ian Banks, and basically
his writing, I think, is the loosest and sexiest of any SF writing I've read.
Okay.
So that's a big call. Why I like it.
Yep.
It is looser and sexier than Delaney.
Oh, okay.
Who writes about sexy.
Yeah.
And Banks doesn't really. It's just his style. His style is sexy.
Yep. Okay.
The other people who really made a difference for me were the cyberpunks. The key things for me were Gibson's Burning Chrome, which really opened every door for me in that space. I love Neil Stephenson's Cryptonomicon, which is a huge book, and I really can't bear his huge books anymore. They're intolerably huge. And I loved everything that Bruce Sterling did, though he doesn't seem to write anymore, really.
Yeah, he doesn't put much out. Every now and again, there's something that pops up, but he's...
But what he did was very unusual. He sort of tinkered with the genre, so it felt like he was in a part of the world that you weren't aware of. So, you know, when Gibson says that the future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed, Sterling actually takes you to those places where the uneven distribution is, and its coming distributions all in one place. You know, so somewhere in Sarawak, you'll be finding yourself in some Sterling story. It's remarkable.
Anybody else?
There's one specific book that I remember very well, China Mountain Jung by Maureen McHugh. Do you recall that?
I know of it. I can't remember having read it.
So we know it's some kind of classic because the Toy Essentials are re-releasing it in April with a very boring cover, I should say. but we do get an introduction by Joe Walton. So China Mountain Jung, which he wrote in 1992, is set in the future when America is a satellite state of an all-powerful China. And the protagonist is a Chinese-American who moves to China to retrain from engineer to architect and to rediscover his cultural heritage and his sexual identity, which is code for being gay, which all rang bells, and the hero shares my family name. So it was one of those things like Fountains of Paradise, where the setting is tropical, equatorial Sri Lanka, and this is set in a kind of China I recognize, having been there. And she spent years in China, so she really got it right. She got all the textures of that inner city kind of right.
Are you reading anything of the new Chinese science fiction that's becoming available?
Well, didn't we all read Liu Cixin?
Well, we did. I read all of it. I read the first one. Three-Body Problem.
Then I went back and read Wandering Earth to check it out before the film.
Okay.
That's what I want to do next. I want to read less Anglo-centric SF. And there's a lot of that around. So the next cab off my rank is specifically Chinese, which is the Ken Liu anthology of Chinese SF. What's it called? Broken Stars or something.
Okay. Yeah. So Ken Liu did all the translations for them. He's doing a lot of work.
Yeah. Isn't he amazing? Yeah. How does he do it?
I don't know. There's some guys that are just basically... You wonder whether there's two or three clones of them to be able to get all the work done, especially him. And then you get others that probably pop out one or two stories a year. And
he's no Ted Chiang.
No, he is no Ted Chiang. He's certainly the other end of the scale in terms of productivity. Mm. He has got these. He's finishing off his massive trilogy of 1,000 pages each book.
I read one.
I haven't got to that one yet. It's on the list.
It's very good, but I thought I'm not going to read another two or three. No,
they're huge. They're real doorstops.
Too much.
Yeah, but
Game of Bloody Thrones.
But it shows you though that there's a change happening, and I think it's a change happening for the better, because it means there are new voices coming in all the time, new perspectives, new ways of looking at things.
That's it, perspective.
And it's just it just opens up so much of these stories that you may have heard, but they are told from a different perspective, and it makes just things.
There's a publishing term for this now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Own voices.
Right.
You know this whole thing about American dirt, which has blown up in the US?
Oh, yes. This
and
the Oprah
has it on as a next book selection.
Yeah.
And she's taken on board the criticism she's heard, and it's going to be a discussion about the book.
Right.
Quite different from her usual mode. And it's a big deal, the perspective thing.
It is. People have to be careful of it. I mean, the classic from an Australian perspective is Tom Keneally's Son of Jimmy Blacksmith. He came out, he told that from the point of view of the Indigenous Australian Jimmy Blacksmith, and he said sometime later that he reevaluated it and he would not be so presumptuous as to do that again. He would tell it from the white perspective because that was his. But you read it and you think, the guy's got an imagination. He's living that life as he sees it. Now, he hasn't come out and stated, this is the only version of this story that you can have, but it is a version that he is imagining.
It is tricky.
It is very tricky, well, and I can see it from his perspective, but I can also see it from the other one.
Eva Honen wrote this brilliant Prime Minister's Literary Awards winning book called Dog Boy, and she writes it, you know, from the point of view of dogs.
All right.
You couldn't really accuse of anything there. Lionel Shriver, I think maybe 3 years ago, made this huge furor at the Sydney Writers Festival. She put on a sombrero and started giving this rant about how she can write from any perspective she likes because it's about imagination. And this is the tricky part, of course, because how else do you write a female character if you're not?
Yes.
Now, how else do you write a different age group? How else do you write
different sexualities, different
political unabled?
Different political perspectives. I don't see there's a problem. What it comes down to is look at the work. Don't look at what you think the work is. Just look at the work and see whether the work, if it all hangs together and it's there and it's consistent, I don't see there's a problem with it myself.
I think looking is the hard part, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it was Orwell that said,
depends,
you know, seeing the end of your nose is hard work. It takes effort.
It does.
So seeing beyond the end of your nose for most of us, I think, is extremely hard work. It's very hard to give up your biases.
Oh, yes.
Very hard to entertain somebody else's point of view. To have that level of empathy is very, very difficult. We'd rather sort of have our own defensive prejudices.
Do you think science fiction, looking at it from different perspectives and different ways of looking at a subject, has helped you in that regard?
I mean, speaking as an alien, I find most of it inauthentic.
Okay. I think on that note, we might finish up with that. Thank you very much.
Now, I spoke to someone I've known, not in person, but only over the internet, someone called Paul Carr, who runs a podcast and has been running a podcast for several years now called the Wow Signal Podcast. And he's a very interesting character in that he has been involved in the American space program in various roles over the years. And so I start off by asking him about his background, how he got into that field of endeavor, and then we move into talking about his the kind of reading he did as a child, which also sort of took him in the same sort of direction. So here's Paul. T- Today I'm talking with Paul Carr, who is someone I first came across through Google+, the late lamented social media platform that Google ran. And I think that's how we came across each other, Paul. And then
he, yes.
Indeed. And then he very kindly invited me to be on his podcast, The Unseen Podcast. But he also runs a more long-running podcast called The Wow Signal Podcast, which we'll talk about in a little while. So, Paul, maybe if you could start by giving a bit of your background, you know, sort of where you grew up, where you went to school, how you got interested in everything you do today.
I was a Sputnik baby. I was born in 1958, a few months after Sputnik went up. Uh-huh. And modern parents, like mine, decided that all babies have to, especially male babies, have to be pushed towards engineering and science and math and made interested in rockets and stuff like, which in my case was really not hard for them at all. Yeah. They did that with just by showing me a picture of a rocket ship, and then I was on it. when I was four, my dad gave me a little math problem to do, and I popped out the answer. I don't know how I did it, but I gave him the answer right away, and he was very impressed. He said, "Well, we got to get you more science books," and so anyway, I was. That was the early days of the space program. I was fascinated with all that stuff. I thought the astronauts were like gods.
And
I was extremely jealous of Neil Armstrong when I was 11 years old, and he was the first man to walk on the moon. I kept thinking how I could stow away and maybe beat him to the down the ladder somehow. Because I felt that was a once in human history, once somebody's going to be the first to walk on the moon. And it should have been me. Of course, I was just a kid full of fantasy. But I never lost that fascination. And I was only an average student. Well, above average, but not much above average. We eventually moved to East Texas, Northeast Texas. And I went to school there. And actually, for a small town in East Texas in the buckle of the Bible Belt, not a bad high school. I went from there to college and studied physics, which I correctly discerned was the right field to study, because in physics, you learn how to solve problems and you learn the basic principles of how nature works, but you don't get locked into a particular way of doing things. And so I said, well, I probably want to get into space engineering at some point, but I don't want to be an engineer, because engineers learn lots of, here's how you do this, here's how you do that, which in 20 years will be laughably obsolete. And so, I mean, if you think about how software engineering was in the 70s compared to how it is now, it's just like, you know, you wouldn't be able to apply much of that knowledge now.
But the principles still apply.
Some of the principles do apply. Yeah. In fact, basic principles and basic problem solving techniques still apply.
Yeah.
And insight into problems, and the tricks and heuristics for finding ways to approach problems have probably not changed a whole lot in hundreds of years. But smart people are still smart people. And you find smart people everywhere you go in the world, and everywhere you look at history, you'll find clever people who can solve difficult problems. And some of them don't even know how smart they are. And so I was lucky. When I thought about going to graduate school out of college, decided not to. The opportunities were mediocre. And so I got an offer from a big aerospace company out on the West Coast, and it seemed to me like an enormous amount of money. It really wasn't, but because I had never lived on the West Coast, I had no idea how expensive things were. So I went out there, and the company is not with us any longer. It's called Hughes Aircraft, but they've been sucked up into well, different companies over the years, but now they're part of Boeing Satellite Systems.
So was this Howard Hughes' company?
It was, yes. It was originally Howard Hughes' company. And they were proud of that. And there was Hughes Aircraft and Hughes Helicopters, and they were a few miles apart. the helicopters got sold off to somebody, and the aircraft, which actually they didn't make any aircraft anymore, but they made lots of other things, including satellites. Yeah. In fact, some of the best selling and most successful satellites on the planet were made by Hughes, and they were hiring young people to keep that going. And so I went there, and I had, that's really where my graduate education was. That's really where I, learning by doing, which is the way I prefer to learn, came about. And I was coding in Fortran, which probably nobody does anymore.
Yeah, I learned in Fortran. My first language was Fortran.
Yeah. And I was programming on a PDP 1170, which probably nobody under 50 will even know what that is, but
no, I've seen one. I've actually worked on one of those.
Yeah, and we thought we were in heaven when we got a VAX. The VAXes are long gone now, but they were actually, for their time, they were wonderful. We wrote software and we trained customers, but more importantly, we planned and executed the orbital operations for satellites. We planned the maneuvers and we planned the missions. So we were essentially the mission design group at Hughes Aircraft. And I was there for a while and I learned a lot. Then I went out to work for a company that used to be called RCA. I don't know who they are. I guess they're Lockheed Martin now. This was the 80s and 90s were an era of very rapid aerospace acquisitions in the U.S. So there were a lot of companies buying other. There was, if you've seen Yellow Submarine, you know, where like the fish eats the fish and then another fish eats that fish. And and then eventually one fish eats the entire ocean. That was aerospace.
Can I take you back a little bit? You said that your parents were very keen to get you into science and technology, but
as were many parents in
that era. But you also, I think, had an interest in science fiction through your reading.
Did that
have an influence on you, your science fiction?
Yeah. Now that was totally me. My parents were not science fiction readers, and of course, science fiction movies were very few and far between back in those days. Science fiction television was basically just Star Trek. We didn't even know about Doctor Who. That was, you know,
No.
I didn't find out about that until I was much older. But I just started reading. I just go to the library and getting science fiction books. I just loved anything that was about the future, and involved rockets and violence and you know, so Asimov, Heinlein, all those guys,
all those classics.
I read a lot of Bradbury,
Martian Chronicles, that sort of book.
Now I think I look back now, the Martian Chronicles I'm not that keen on anymore, but the Bradbury in general I am. I mean, he got me through some tough times. Sometimes I would just be so feeling overwhelmed, and I would just grab a Bradbury collection of short stories and sit down, and I'd be okay in an hour or two.
There's sort of comfort to them, isn't there?
I mean, he just took me away. Dandelion Wine was actually my favorite Bradbury book.
Which is interesting because that's not really science fiction at all, is it? But there's some beautiful.
Well, there's some
bits
rockets in it. There are rockets that land, and but it's just a beautiful stories about a young boy, and I was a young boy.
That's so right.
I was totally into that. Yeah, and Martian Chronicles and Illustrated Man, and I read a lot of Asimov. Mm-hmm. I read some Heinlein. I would get these magazines that were at that time, and you could go into an American grocery store and buy, I don't know what they called the format. It was a fairly small science fiction magazine like Amazing Story. Ben Bova had one, and they'd be in the checkout counter. This was early 70s. They'd be in the checkout counter. You could just pick one up, and it was great fun, you know, just reading. And a lot of the stories were very mature, and I probably wasn't supposed to be reading about all these adult things. But
well, knowing science fiction of the time, it wouldn't have raised any eyebrows today.
No, not today, but back then they had people like Harlan Ellison who would write about sex and Satanism in the same sentence, you know.
Yes, yes.
Without, you know, it just blow right through. And you know, and of course, when you're 12, you find all that fascinating.
Yes.
Even though you're living in the Bible Belt and there's a lot of potential condemnation for almost anything that deviates from the moral canon, so to speak. Even though all around you, you see people gleefully violating it. I did love that. I loved science fiction as a kid, and I read a lot of science fiction books. I had piles of them. I can't even remember all the... I read all of Dune. I think I read most of the Dune books. I read all of Foundation. I just gobbled the stuff up. I didn't do a lot of homework, but I
that's all right.
It was a combination of the questions not being very challenging and also not having a very long attention span. Science fiction is the one thing I could pay attention to for an extended period of time. And I had a shortwave radio, and I would tune in, I would play with that, and I would listen to often things in languages I didn't understand. And I had that in my room, and I had a stack of science fiction books. And so I grew up on that, and I also read, you know, nonfiction. Like, well, a lot of it was Asimov, because
yes.
He wrote
a lot of nonfiction. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how many books the man wrote. He wrote enough books for four or five authors.
I think it was about 300 by the time he died. Yeah.
Yeah. Guide to the Bible.
Yeah. Guide to Shakespeare.
It's just amazing the stuff that he, Inside the Atom. I also read some things like that interest me. Like, I was interested in relativity in particular, and I read about Einstein. I would say, that can't be right. There's no way that can really happen. And then I'd read some more and say, well, okay, scientists say it really does happen. Especially relativity captivated me, even though because it was weird. And yet it was mainstream science at the, even, you know, long before I was born. And I was fascinated with that. That made me think I wanted to study physics, because that was really cool. And there was an elegance and neatness to it that wow, it's just a few equations and you've got this vast panorama of things that can happen. And then I occasionally would encounter science fiction stories where time dilation would be an important element.
Yes. What was that book by Paul Anderson, Tau Zero? Did you remember that one?
I think I do remember that. And there was something else about... It's a blur now.
Yeah, that's right.
I probably did read that one.
It's where they're in a spaceship and they actually can't stop and they keep on accelerating at 1G and getting closer and closer to the speed of light. And, of course, time dilates and they end up at the very end of the universe, I think. And so that's the end of the book. But it's pretty well done.
A few years later, I discovered the real book about the end of the universe, and then the restaurant of the end of the universe.
Oh, the restaurant. Yes, indeed.
Well, that was in I was in college then. The public radio had the Douglas Adams radio series on there. And we, a bunch of us physics majors, would sit around in the basement of the physics building listening to it, and we were just laughing our heads off.
Oh, yeah, very funny.
And yet, you could tell there was a real affection there for science fiction, even though it was a bit of a parody, but it was an affectionate parody. I love that. And I became a big Douglas Adams fan and read everything he wrote.
Yeah. I think you're also a bit of a Terry Pratchett fan. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, that came much later. I well into adulthood, And I think, and I started reading the books in order, which you don't really have to do.
But, no, the first
well, you don't have
books,
to do it that, but you know, maybe the first two or three. But yeah, I always recommend Terry Pratchett to anyone who's looking for a good, hard nosed laugh. Terry Pratchett's insight into it. He's writing about this fantasy world, but he's really writing about us.
Yes, you know, very much
and,
so.
I love Terry Pratchett. I mourn his passing in 2015. In fact, the Unseen Podcast, well, the name of the Unseen Podcast, I didn't have a name. I was coming up, bouncing around different names, and I was about to start the podcast, and Terry Pratchett, I knew he was sick. I didn't know how sick he was. He died, I think it was March 2015. And that was a terrible shame. And he one of his fictional places was the Unseen University. If you've read any Terry Pratchett at all, you'll probably read into the Unseen University.
Oh, yes.
Certainly sure. The first few books.
Yeah.
And the Unseen University, I thought, well, why not the Unseen Podcast? And because the thing is, the Unseen University wasn't unseen so much. It's just the name is kind of a joke. But I thought, in fact, well, the Unseen University is a very funny place, a very blood-soaked funny place. But you have to read it. I can't explain it well. People should just get a hold of a random Terry Pratchett book and read it. It will take you less time than you think because it's funny and you move fast through it. But the Unseen University and, all these things will stick in your head forever. You'll have a very positive, warm feeling about Terry Pratchett. Even though there's a lot of violence and misdeeds in all the books.
That's true.
You still come away feeling a warm fuzzy for him, for Terry Pratchett and his stories.
Sure. Now, I interrupted you when you were talking about you'd got to start work at RCA. Is there anything beyond that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I moved from the West Coast to the East Coast, to New Jersey, which is the East Coast, Princeton. And I wasn't going to take the job, but I stopped in Princeton to see what that, which is a nearby town, not right where the work was. And I fell in love with Princeton, New Jersey. It's just such a charming little town, with one of the major universities in the whole world right there, but a small place. Princeton University is not a big monster place. It's a very old, very, distinguished university. I just love the town. And I said, if I could live here, I will go work there. And they had lots of good work at the time. They had projects that interest me. So I went there and worked there for 10 years. Well, there and also once I got moved out to a Pennsylvania location and I came back. But I went from a guy who did orbit planning and orbit analysis to a systems engineer during that 10 years. I transitioned. I still did the orbit analysis, but in the context of systems design and system engineering, I sort of found my calling then. I knew I didn't want to do anything other than space at that point. I knew that from the time I was a kid, but at the time there were only a few companies in the U.S. that really could do that because it took, at that time, big facilities and big capital investment and a big bureaucracy to deal with all the government contracting. And now, with the new space, you have more choices and more locations you can go to. It's a good time to be a young person in the space field. I don't know about other parts of the country, of the world, but in the U.S., it's certainly a good time, because companies like Blue Origin and SpaceX and,
mm-hmm. It's and very exciting.
even much smaller companies are all over the place, and they are doing exciting work. And I really do hope that the explosion and the push forward that we were great believers in the 80s, thought was going to happen in the 80s. We thought the space shuttle was going to be our ticket to the to space, and it was going to be our we were wrong about that, of course. But you know, a lot of people like myself had the same belief. We're gonna ride that magnificent machine to orbit, and it's going to lower the cost of going to orbit by an order of magnitude, which it didn't, of course.
No,
but
no.
And we're going to start building a spacefaring civilization. And there really was a fervent belief that I had and lots of other people had, and it didn't happen at all. And we sat around blaming the politicians, and then after a while we said, you know, I think people like the younger generation said, yeah, if you wait for the politicians, it'll never happen.
It might never happen. Yeah, that's right.
They will certainly make a lot of noise. There will be a lot of PowerPoint charts. There will be vast billions of dollars spent that are largely wasted, but there won't be, and there was a lot of money spent on the space station. There was a lot of money spent on the shuttle, huge amounts of money. We could be living on Mars now if we had taken that same money and, you know, said, let's go to Mars. We realized, I think through the 90s and so on, after there was, you know, George Bush saying the space station is Ronald Reagan, here's your space station. It's going to be our stepping stone exploration. And then George Bush Sr. saying, well, okay, let's have the Space Exploration Initiative, which was presented to Congress, and Congress said, no, not spending that amount of money. Forget it. And then Bill Clinton was a little more conservative in his approach, kind of a gradual thing. And then George Bush says, let's have the Vision for Space Exploration, which ended up being a corporate welfare program. And then, and so, you know, we kept going forward and forward with hoping that NASA would save us. And NASA, by the way, NASA does wonderful work in what they are good at, which is exploring the planets.
Yes, absolutely. Fantastic.
And NASA is extremely good at that, and also Earth science, which is less visible, less known to the public, but extremely important. I think people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos just said, you know what? we've sung this song before. Let's go another way.
Yeah, I must say, when I first saw that Falcon Heavy launch and the simultaneous landing of the two booster rockets that were being retrieved, I must say, I thought at that moment, if only Robert Heinlein could have been here to see this.
It was like something out of science fiction. The books that I'd read as a child.
Yeah, those two rockets coming
rockets
down.
Rockets land and two rockets terrific. At the same time.
Yeah,
yeah, it was beautiful. And, you know, there's still an awful lot of work ahead and a lot of risk ahead. There's nothing guaranteed. Nothing is inevitable. But I do believe that we're kind of on the right track now. And here I am in my 60s, and I'm no longer the generation that can drive this forward.
But you can watch.
I'm hoping that I can help. Yeah. Yeah. I'm still working in the space field.
Yeah.
Because it takes a lot of shoulders to the wheel to make everything happen. You know, I hopefully that will continue for me for a few more years at least. And if my health holds up, which it, so far it has. But the young folks are doing great. We train them well.
Yeah,
I would like to take credit for that.
We train them well.
And they are doing wonderful things. I did work briefly on the New Horizons program I shouldn't say briefly, 2 years or so before it was launched. I saw a lot of talented young people working on that. There was a lot of dynamic, and they're not just in the U.S., all over. And some of them are coming to the U.S. to work work here, but which is, I welcome. In fact, a lot of my friends in the industry are immigrants. They came to the U.S. to usually as graduate students, and then stayed and became citizens. Even got security clearances in some cases, and have done great. So, you know, there's the worldwide talent pool is stunning. There's so many people there can, they're all over the place, so they can achieve enormous things. And, you know, we should welcome them in.
All right, Paul. Well, I think we might start winding it up there.
Okay.
I really appreciate time.
Yeah.
And, it's been good talking to you. We must catch up again in the future.
Yeah, well, anytime, David.
Well, thanks to Paul, thanks to John for those insights. As you can see, there's similarities, but also some differences. And it's just interesting to hear how people came to the field and whether they've stayed with it all this time. You find that some people come in and leave, and some people, like the two of us, David, we just stayed with it most of our lives, and we're still going to be here.
Stick
in the muds. That's exactly right. Okay, well, I think that's about it, David. I think
we're done for
this week, a long episode.
Indeed.
Next week's will also be a long episode because we're not going to restrict ourselves to 1 or 2 minutes about the particular books that we're going to be talking about. I think I'll probably rabbit on far too long about some of my favourites, and I'm sure David will do the same.
Indeed.
And so that is probably going to be a longish episode as well, so something to sit back and listen to in your armchair, or when you're out for a walk and put your headphones on, listen to a podcast, and make your daily walk go a little bit quicker.
That's how I do it. That's great. Okay, thanks. Thanks, Perry. We'll see you next time.
Yep. Thanks, David. See you then.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.